Americans and all the world to know. American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
Every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. That opening was from the play White House Wise Operation Lisa Strada, which will be performed this week at the Exchange, Sunday, October the 28th, 2012, at 3 o'clock at the downtown Los Angeles Exchange, located at 114 West 5th Street. Now, this week we will be talking about women's in the theater with Yvonne Farrell, the director of the play, White House Wise Operation Lisa Strada, which was written by her twin sister, Yvette Heiliger. As I mentioned earlier, the play will be performed this Sunday, October the 28th, 2012, at 3 o'clock at the downtown L.A. Exchange, located at 114 West 5th Street. And Yvonne, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Oh, hello, Melvin. Hello, Earlene.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Okay, now in a minute we'll be on the line from New York with the playwright Yvette Heiliger, who is the twin sister of Yvonne. But Yvonne, first of all, tell us a little about you're the director of the play. How did this come about?
Well, Yvette and I have a production company called Twin Biz. We write, produce, and direct original projects for stage, television, and film. And our company's been in existence over 25 years. Over 20 years, close to 25 years. And generally, Yvette is the writer and director of her plays when we work together. And it just so happens that she is having an event in New York, mm-hmm. So I will be serving as director as well as actress on this project.
Wow, huh?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's exciting. Wonderful.
It is exciting.
Yeah. Wow. And I think that first we're on the line with Yvette from New York. Yvette. Hello, Yvette.
Yes. Hey, Melvin.
Hi,
how are
Yvette.
You?
Fine. How you doing?
Glad to hear your voice.
Yeah.
I'm good. I'm all fired up now that I've watched the debate.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah, we saw a little of it also, got a little fired. Now, you're the author of the play White House Wise Operation Lisa Strada.
That's right.
Yeah, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Now, tell us a little about yourself and how did you get off into the theater, especially playwriting?
Oh, well, I started out in show business as an actor, and in graduate school I discovered I had a talent for playwriting because in their master's program in the Gallatin School of Individualized Study, we were required as artists to present ourselves in a performance project and then to write a thesis about it. But I decided instead of doing someone else's play, there was plenty going on in my life, that I would take a stab at writing my first play.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And so that's how I started writing. And at that time, they said in Gallatin that it was the best thesis that they had received to that date.
Mm-hmm.
And that I should really think about being a writer.
Okay.
And I was like, no, I don't want to be a writer. I want to be an actor, you know. I think that it was a blessing to discover that I had a talent because it really empowered me as an artist.
Yeah, what was your thesis on?
Oh, it was a play called, my very first play called Autobiography of a Homegirl.
Hmm.
And basically it looks at race and beauty in America and why we make the choices we make we make for our mates.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I mean, it's not interracial dating is not a big deal right now, but at that time, I was very crushed that my boyfriend at the time was deciding to leave me for a white woman. And I didn't really understand the politics of it and what that was all about. And so the play was really an exploration of the whole light-skin, dark-skin issue in our community,
yes.
Racial politics, the toys children play with that affects their self-esteem, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, that sounds like a great play.
Yeah, Yvonne, my sister, played Renetta, the leading character in that and play.
Now, tell us what this play is about, White House Wives Operation Lisa Strada, and what inspired you to write this play?
Well, the play is a what-if play, and it's basically what if the First Lady, Laura Bush, had proposed a sex strike to the wives of the architects of the war in Iraq before Congress had voted to go to war. And that's the premise of the play. It's inspired by Aristophanes' play, Lysistrata, where the women decide to go on a sex strike to get the Athens to quit fighting with the other country. Escapes me right now, but to get the war to end.
Okay.
So the play is set in 2002, just 1 year after the tragic events of September 11th. It takes place in the Lincoln bedroom of the White House, and Laura Bush has called together the key players, Lynn Cheney, Alma Powell, Cherie Blair, Tony Blair's wife, and others, under the guise of redecorating the Lincoln bedroom, but secretly they're meeting so that Laura can expose her plan, which is to try to win their support for withdrawing sex from their husbands. So they come, you know, the wives come with their paint samples, their fabric swatches, and decorating magazines, only to discover the First Lady's true purpose, to enlist them in a sex strike. So that's the premise of the play.
Okay, we're looking forward to it. Let me ask you this. What playwright or theater personality influenced you the most?
That would be Athel Fugard. I'm so jealous because my sister got a chance to be in one of his plays. But in New York City back in the 80s, Master Harold and the Boys was on Broadway. And I got to see Zeke Mackay, I hope I'm saying his name right, and Danny Glover as the two leading men in that play. And you know, set in South Africa about a little white South African boy who's very close to his black, I guess, nanny, if you could call it that. And then the boy grows up and suddenly he's spitting in the guy's face. And so, you know, just how you grow up into the racism of a system and adopt it.
Yeah.
And I was so struck by this play, and I sat in my chair when the curtain came down, and I just was crying uncontrollably.
Yes.
And in a Broadway theater, you know, they try to get you out the door, but there's like, oh, let this girl sit here and cry, you know. I just could not get myself up out of the seat.
Yes.
And that was the first time that I realized that theater could be used as an effective tool for social change.
Yes.
That we can be both entertained and moved to change the world all at the same time. So that's who I would say, Athel Fugard.
Great playwright and a great play. Now, I read your play, and you mentioned a fictitious lesbian relationship involving a high-profile cabinet member. Can you comment on that?
Well, in the play, I have... Yvonne, help me.
Condoleezza
Rice. I'm drawing a blank. Condoleezza Rice is engaged in a fictitious lesbian relationship with a character that I call Significant Other. And obviously it's a lie. We all know it's a lie. But within the world of the play, we have Significant Other in this relationship with Condoleezza Rice, which by the end of the play, we come to understand that the playwright inserting this lie into the play is analogous, is that the right word? is parallel to what Bush and Cheney did with inserting this lie about Iraq and why we were there.
All right, okay.
So it's really a metaphor for what they did.
All right.
You know, we're selling it, we're sticking to our story, and that's why Significant Other exists in the play.
Okay, now is there any meaning to having a gay African-American stage manager in the play also? Any subtextual meaning there, anything?
Well, I wanted to have, in my play, I break a lot of rules.
Mm-hmm.
The Greeks were masters at, you know, throwing in a lot of techniques and having a lot of fun in their plays. And so I break a lot of theatrical conventions. I break the fourth wall. I have the audience talking back. I have them reading stage directions. I do a mm-hmm. whole gamut of stuff just to have fun and to enjoy this theatrical experience. And mm-hmm. one of those things is having the existence of the stage manager, who in theater we traditionally know as someone who's backstage you never see. You know, he's the one calling the shots, calling the cues as given by the director. And you don't hear from this person. You don't see this person. This is an invisible person that's holding up the fabric of the show. But within my play, this is a real life person. And mm-hmm. so the stage manager because some of the characters left or walked off, the stage manager is having to come on stage and play certain roles. Now, with regard to the subject of sex, and withholding sex, I had to make sure that all my bases were covered with regard to men and their sexual appetites.
Okay.
Because you would have all these older wives. You have, Laura Bush, Lynn Cheney. These are all old gals. I mean, who cares if they withhold sex? So I had to introduce mistresses, and then I had to introduce the K character, because, of course, we have men who sleep with men.
Yes.
So I was trying to cover every sexual base I could cover. So having a gay character within the play just help me to achieve, as a playwright, the goal of withholding sex so that nobody's getting any sex, not even, you know, crossing the line and having sex with men.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. What do you think about the role of...
You were so calm about that answer.
Yeah. I thought that was a great answer. I'd be able to really evaluate it when I see how the director lay it out.
Okay.
But what do you think about the role of women in the theater today?
In our country, that is in all 50 states, women theater artists get less than 17% of production opportunities throughout the entire nation. Men continue to get the lion's share of work, getting their plays produced, directing, getting the jobs in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So we are now in a whole new millennium, and it's as if we're back, you know, in the 1900s, you know, in terms of our advancements in theater as women and getting those economic opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me and for Yvonne, what we've chosen to do with our little company, Twin Biz, is to not sit back and wait for people to offer us jobs, but to create those opportunities for ourselves. In New York City, you have a lot of playwrights and actors who have become what we call producing artists.
Mm-hmm.
You get out there and you make things happen for yourself. If you're an actor and you want to be seen, you know, it's like when Yvonne invited me to Los Angeles to come and do my first play. The play became an opportunity for her to be seen by the industry. You know, actors are doing that here. Playwrights are saying, look, my plays are collecting dust. Let me get out there and do it. But this is even more important for women, because mm-hmm. we're not getting the opportunities. Things have gotten better, yes. But if you move outside of the metropolitan areas and go across the country, you know, less than 17%, and it's even been as low for women of color, like less than half of that for women of color. And for African-American women, it's been as low as 1%.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you make a difference between commercial theater and community theater? Are you, in terms of those stats?
I don't because in the 80s, mm-hmm. when I first started doing theater, I just assumed that I could go to a black community theater, that they would want to do my play, that I would have a home in the theater. And that wasn't the case. And that was a little bit of a rude awakening for me, because I felt like the Good Old Boys Network was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even know much about the theater at the time, but I saw that, you know, the men were still enjoying the men, supporting the men,
mm-hmm.
and for the most part.
Well, let me ask you this.
So for me, mm-hmm. the commercial theater and community theater, in that instance, as a playwright who's struggling to develop their voice and to find a theatrical home, it just didn't exist for me. Now, maybe it's existed for other women, you know, okay, that's great, you know, but then how many of us have had that opportunity? I don't mean to come off
so harshly. Let me ask you this. How important do you consider the female playwright in terms of changing that concept, changing the process of the women's involvement in theater?
Well, I feel that the diversity of voices is very important. I'm with my white sister playwrights in mm-hmm. terms of we're all in this together. We got to get jobs and opportunities, but as a woman of color, I don't just have my sex to deal with. I have race to deal with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think it's important for white women to also pull up women of color into the conversation and make sure that their work is done and their work is represented.
Okay. Now, Yvonne, do you have a question for Yvette?
Let's see. Yvette, how do you feel in casting your plays? Are you really looking in terms of word for word what you have on the page, or can you be influenced by what walks in the room?
I feel because I also direct, and I have to thank Yvonne for that, because she was the first person who suggested that I even think about directing, and it was something I had never considered before. But when someone walks in a room, I'm looking for an intangible thing. Maybe they're not necessarily perfect for the role, but they have a particular quality that could really shine within the character that is they're auditioning for. So, you know, sometimes producers have sat next to me and gone, "Now, are you sure about this person? Are you sure about that person?" You know, yes, there's something about that person that's going to shine in my play. And particularly with my play, What Would Jesus Do?, and we were casting it in New York, mm-hmm. the producer who was in on the casting session, "I know, you're sure, Yvette?" And I said, "No, let this actress go back and read for this other role, because there's something about her that will shine in this other role, not for the role she came in for." So
okay.
I hope that answered the question.
Now, Yvette, do you have a question for Yvonne?
Well, I was going to ask Yvonne. Yvonne has played different characters within my plays, and I was wondering for her which one was the most challenging. She's played Mrs. Wilson in What Would Jesus Do? About HIV/AIDS in the church. She played Renetta in the first play that I mentioned, Autobiography of a Homegirl, and she is now playing Alma Powell in Codename in White House Wives Operation Lysistrata.
Okay.
I just was wondering which role may have been the most challenging for her.
Which one, Yvonne?
They were all hard roles. She writes tour de force roles. And when I say you're on the stage for the whole play, you're mostly on the stage for the whole play. I mean, it takes tremendous strength to play all three of those women. But I would have to say, What Would Jesus Do? Because we were dealing with HIV yeah. and AIDS. And she is a woman who's an upstanding church-going woman. And she's on top when the play opens, and you see her disintegrate through finding out that she may have been infected with the virus by her husband.
Yeah.
And so it's quite a huge turn. And she's fighting with her faith and forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took a lot of strength. And even, you know, as an actor, I've been taught, Yvette and I are both Meisner trained, that you take a seed of truth and then you use your imagination to let it grow and expand. So to have to take yourself there every night,
mm-hmm.
To be that open and that vulnerable and that emotionally, it's like a river. It's flowing. It was tremendously, I mm-hmm. loved it.
Okay.
But I'd come off stage drenched in tears or sweat.
Okay. Look, let's not, Yvette, we're going to keep
you. She left it all on the stage.
I did. I did.
Yeah, Yvette, we're going to keep you on the line. I want to get some information from Yvonne. I want to talk to Yvonne for a while.
Okay.
No, but we'll keep you on the line. Yvonne, can you tell us a little about yourself? How did you get off into the theater?
Well, I started in the business as a dancer. That was my dream. I wanted to dance. And I had worked very hard at that. And at about age 28, both of my legs, I had injured both my legs. I had been in a ballet company, mm. the Dance Theater of Harlem. And mm-hmm. I'd injured both of my legs. And I couldn't walk for about 2 years. So that was in the prime of my life as a dancer. 1920, that's when folks were doing it. But I pulled myself together and was able to go back to Alvin Ailey, where I had had a scholarship, and get into the third company and work with Alvin, actually, on his very first production, a ballet called Memoria, where he used all three of his companies.
Hmm.
But my body just couldn't stand it. And my last show is when I met my husband. I auditioned for a show going to Monte Carlo, and he was the conductor arranger of the show and wrote all the music. And that's I had to audition for him.
That was Larry.
Yes. and then I came to L.A. and got married, and I became an actor here, retooled myself as a Meisner-trained actress. I worked a lot in New York, and Yvette and I did a lot of commercials. And that is how I became an actor.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I got involved. And Yvette had an idea to start a company, and we did it. We started it, and we got going. And, you know, my agent used to say, let me help you. You were so, you know, you're working so hard. But I knew that I just couldn't sit back and wait for my phone to ring in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've done quite well here in television. I really have. But in terms of theater, it's live, it's breathing, it's immediate. You know, and anything can happen. There's an excitement and also an avenue to to really grow a character and take a journey. Whereas in television, yeah. Yvette's on AOL.
Yeah.
Sorry.
In television, you know, you have a few lines or a couple scenes, and yeah. then you're off unless you're the leading in a series.
The flow. Well, let me ask you this, what I asked Yvette earlier. Mm-hmm. What theater personality influenced you the most?
Well, I came out of dance, but at that time, the Negro Ensemble Company had mm-hmm. some of the best talent.
Mm-hmm.
And Yvette was, she'd do things like Usher and things at Negro Ensemble mm-hmm. Company. And I'd come from class, from Ailey's, and we'd be hanging out there. And I saw some of the best theaters. And, I mean, Denzel came out of there. Charlie mm-hmm. Brown came out of there. Adolph Caesar, Barbara Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
Leon Morenzi. Yvette, you know, can you think of anyone else? I mean,
oh, yeah,
just Samuel Jackson.
Samuel Jackson.
Yeah,
those people were like the salt of the earth, the grit. They were in there doing that theater, and we were
James Pickens.
James yeah. Pickens, exactly.
Yeah.
Sitting there watching them.
Great mm-hmm. company. Okay, now this is for both of y'all. I'd like to get some comments on it. What are some of the challenges of being black and a woman in the theater? You want to take that, Yvonne, and then we'll hear from Yvette.
I find that theater is kinder to women than you know, the entertainment business as a whole, TV mm-hmm. and film. I find as you get older, it is more difficult to work. This is a youth-oriented situation in television and film. But in theater, you can work forever, and there's a value on being that character actress
mm-hmm.
and having those lines and that gray hair. And, you know, you are valued and held up and, you know, you're not treated as if you're old and you're, well, let's get on to the next and, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
How about you, Yvette?
Well, aside from what I said before about the the inequities that exist in the theater world with regard to opportunities for women. Aside from that, I guess I'd have to say that when I first started writing for the theater, we were whores. We were crackheads. They didn't have crack back then, but mm-hmm. we were mammies and whores, pretty much. You didn't have black women as the doctor, the lawyer, you know, the professional businesswoman. And so when I started writing, I was writing for the middle class woman. Yvonne and I grew up in a very middle class home and lifestyle. And there was really nothing for our type. And so when I started writing, I was writing for my type, which was the middle class woman, which was the doctor, the lawyer, mm-hmm. you know, the professional woman, the Claire Huxtable woman. And so, you know, nowadays we see that we get to play a wide variety of roles, you know, and it was interesting to me to see someone like Halle Berry fighting to play the crackhead mother in Losing Isaiah. Was that the name of the movie?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, or to be in one of Spike Lee's films mm-hmm. As a character that was not this upper middle class, upwardly mobile woman. So I guess at the time that was a challenge. And so it's just so wonderful now that we're seen in all different lights. And then on the other side of that, you had then all the criticism about Clara Huxtable and the Cosbys. Mm. That's not real black people. You know, that's not real black life.
Yeah.
And so it's just interesting how the pendulum swings.
Yeah. In reality, I don't think it was a lot of people loved that as a creative piece. But let me ask you this. What are your thoughts? You know, in this country, during the 20s, it was a writer named Theophilus Lewis. He reviewed mostly black plays during the 20s around Harlem and all that. And he really pushed for a national African-American theater company. Now, we have had national African-American theater company. They used to call it the Negro Section of the Federal Theater Project that lasted all the way up until the 30s, until they destroyed it because they felt it had so many communists in it. But what are your thoughts? I want to get some thoughts from both you and Yvonne about the need for a national African-American theater company.
Hmm. Have you heard of the National Black Theater Festival?
Yes.
That takes place every 2 years?
Yeah, but what I got in mind... When I say a national African-American theater company, mm-hmm. I'm talking about a theater company that's really national, centralized in one area, but located and connected in all of these major cities like New York, Detroit, L.A. So when one do a play in one city, they automatically, they guarantee a road trip in terms of... I look at that as being the major weakness that we have in African-American theater now, so segmentized, where the people in L.A., they don't know what's going on in Chicago or Detroit or vice versa like that. This is what Theophilus Lewis had in mind. He had something that would create a separate economy, almost like what happened when you had the Negro Baseball League in all of these cities and stuff. So when I'm talking, the festival is nice in terms of bringing... but I don't look at that as being, but when I'm talking about something that really impacts the African-American community as a whole in terms of creating writers, actors, directors, the whole thing in terms of that.
Right, mm-hmm. So a national community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it would be a wonderful thing to have a national African-American theater company, and I feel that it's a topic that should be proposed. And Yvonne mentioned the National Black Theater Festival. You know, maybe a paper could be submitted and a discussion started, or maybe even with mm-hmm. the Black Theater Network about that very thing. I just wonder, you know, it's interesting Yvonne mentioned the National Black Theater Festival because Larry Leon Hamlin, who founded it,
mm-hmm.
brought wanted to bring all these black theaters to the table. Let's work together was the reason why he started that festival. Why are we all so divided when we can work together? Mm-hmm. And so that the spirit of that, I think, is what you're talking about. But to me, like in Harlem, you have a bunch of churches here because everybody's got to have their own pulpit. I just wish that the desire to have your own pulpit the desire to have a national theater would be greater than the desire to have your own pulpit. Mm-hmm. We got so many churches, you know, and so let's unite under one church. But then that's hard because in the black theater, producers have their own likes and dislikes. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. they're gonna like the plays they like and not like the plays they don't like. And being African American doesn't necessarily give you entree into a black theater because that black producer is going to like what he or she likes and doesn't like.
Exactly.
So I think it would some consciousness raising mm-hmm. and some nation building mm-hmm. ideals would have to start to be developed in terms of raising the consciousness of the community in order to get to a national African American theater company. But that's an exciting idea, and Yvonne and I would love to join in the discussion on that.
Well, we're going to we're going to go into our community calendar in a minute, and then we're going to get more into what we think it takes to lay the foundation for that. But let's take a break for our community calendar, and then we'll come back with our discussion.
Okay.
This is the community calendar for the month of October. Every Tuesday from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., the Veterans Community Theater Workshop is being held. This workshop is open to veterans and non-veterans. The location is the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard, Los Angeles. This is near the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic. The Metro bus number 60 and 66 stops at the corner. For more information, contact 213-479-1764. The number again is 213-479-1764. Sunday, October the 28th at 3 p.m., Drama Stage Qumran present in the Son of Play reading series. This play is written by Yvette Heiliger and directed by Yvonne Farrell. The play is entitled White House Wives, Operation Lisa Strada. Following the reading, there will be a Q&A, a mixer, and light refreshments will be served. The location is The Exchange, 114 West 5th Street, Los Angeles, California. For more information or to RSVP, please call 213-479-1764. Once again, the number is 213-479-1764. Upcoming guests on the Qumran Report, Monday, October the 29th, will be Tawana Green. She has a collection of inspirational poems, and she will be doing some of her readings on the show at that time. Also, Sister Esther, she has a radio show on KTYM Gospel radio show. She will also be our guest. We're asking you to save the date, Friday, November the 9th, 7 p.m. November is Homeless Awareness Month, and Drama Stage Qumran will be performing a play called Surviving the Nickel, written and directed by Melvin Ishmael Johnson. The performance will be on the USC campus at Ground Zero Coffee Shop. The Compassionate Response to Homelessness and Poverty Group is sponsoring this event. This is just a reminder, if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. Also, our call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our hosts.
Hey, thank you, Miss Earlene Anthony. Now we're back with our in studio guest Yvonne Farrell, and on the line from New York, Yvette Heiliger, and also my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Now, one of the things I would like to talk about now, at our organization, Drama Stage, we work with a concept that we call the RATE concept. And the RATE concept means relevant, affordable theater experience. And we feel that community theater, it should be relevant to the community. It should be affordable, so they should be able to attend the. And I want to get some comments on how can we make our community theater more affordable to the community. Let's start out with you, Yvonne.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because when we produced the first the play that Twin Biz did together, our launch, Yvette and I gave away seats to underprivileged, battered, abused, recovering alcoholics, women that had never seen theater, mm-hmm. ever. So we always kept aside a certain amount of seats so that they could have the experience and then have a little talk back afterwards. Mm-hmm. So we've always been concerned with social outreach and making theater affordable. Now, at that time, our tickets were only $10, and everyone else was charging $25 and, you know, $45 and $50. And Yvette and I wanted to keep it down so that the community could come. We were sold out, but we didn't make any money.
Yeah.
You know, we could barely, you know, pay the bills.
Yeah.
And so a lot of what kept that show going had to do with, you know, we got extension after extension, but we were only at $10.
Yeah.
You know, but we've always been conscious of letting theater be something that everyone can go to and love. Especially because Yvette writes plays about social issues and things that you're getting your medicine and with a spoon of sugar.
Yes.
And she's able to ride that line between entertainment and then education.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a great opportunity for people to learn about HIV and AIDS, about beauty in America, about she writes about the White House all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to, I think if you keep theater tickets at a very high price range, then you leave out a whole segment of the population.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Yvette? You want to comment on that?
Well, I think we're unfortunately living in it, and I guess I'm speaking from someone who lives in New York City, and I know how high the rent is for theaters here, and I understand the producers' woes about having to keep the lights on and the doors open. I mean, I get that, but. So for me, I guess the alternative would have to be, you know, sharpening up those skills in grant writing so that you can write grants that will enable you to get the monies you need to keep the costs down. Mm-hmm. And also sponsorship, you know, for your plays, you know, like the Apollo Theater has had, which is a not-for-profit organization for a while now, you know, lucked up getting Coca-Cola sponsoring Amateur Night.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the community has to be educated with regard to grant writing, how to write effective grants, how to write effective budgets, how to get those monies, how to be a contender in that world. And you often find that those kind of skills are lacking. So I think a lot of educational workshops could happen for small theaters and community theaters that would help them to become competitive, mm-hmm. and get those grants.
Okay, beautiful. Now, I would like to discuss three pioneer women of the theater, Florence Mills, Anita Bush, and Rose McClinton. First, let me read something on each one of them. I'm going to read something on Anita Bush. We'll talk about her for a minute. This is from the Wikipedia. Anita Bush, born August 1st, 1883, died February 16th, 1974. She was an American stage actress and playwright. She founded the Anita Bush Players, an all-color dramatic stock company, in 1915, a pioneer black repertory theater company that helped launch the career of Charles Gilpin, Dooley Wilson, Evelyn Perrier, and others. Now, what I would like to say about Anita Bush, she also laid the foundation for the first stock, African-American stock company, successful one here in the United States, the Lafayette Theater Companies in New York. And any comments on Anita Bush?
How inspiring.
Yeah.
I mean, to know that she really pushed for herself and her opportunities for her community.
Yes.
I mean, it's just wonderful. Yvette and I received at the National Black Theater Festival last year the Emerging Producer Award.
Mm-hmm.
And they honored us for pushing like this. This woman has pushed and created a way
yes.
where there was no way. And I find that very, very inspiring.
Mm-hmm. You guys was at the one in Winston-Salem?
Right. It's
yeah,
in Greensboro, but you find
the
Winston-Salem.
Yeah, the same one last year. Yes. Because I think we
have... You're grateful to know that you're standing on the shoulders of those who have done what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who were entrepreneurial and who, from acting, started writing and then producing and having their own theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an important history lesson for us to know as entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and what I found so interesting about Anita Bush is... And we just got to talk about women's in the theater, but she was in charge.
Right.
She was running the Lafayette, the Anita Bush Players, and she was running the Lafayette Theater Company. Really laid the foundation for that company, and they travel all over the United States. The next person I want to read about is one of my favorites. And, I really love talking about her. Her name is Florence Mills. And I'm going to have Earlene read something about Florence Mills.
Florence Mills, born Florence Winfrey, January 25th, 1896, to November the 1st, 1927. She was known as the Queen of Happiness, was an African-American cabaret singer, dancer, and comedian. She was known for her effervescent stage presence, delicate voice, and winsome wide-eyed beauty. And she is a beauty. I'm looking at her picture. She was the daughter of a former enslaved parents, Nellie Simon and John Winfrey. She was born Florence Winfrey in Washington, D.C. She began performing as a child when at the age of 6, she sang duet with her two older sisters. They eventually formed the vaudeville act, calling themselves the Mill Sisters. The act did well, appearing in theaters up and down the Atlantic seaboard. Florence Sisters eventually quit performing, but Florence stayed with it, determined to pursue a career in show business. In time, she joined Ada Smith, Cora Green, and Carolyn Williams in a group called the Panama Four, with which she had some success. Mills became well known as a result of her role in the successful Broadway musical Shuffle Along in 1921 at Daly's 63rd Street Theater, barely on Broadway. One of the events credited with beginning the Harlem Renaissance, as well acclaimed reviews in London, Paris, Liverpool, and other European venues. Mill told the press that despite her years in vaudeville, she believed that Shuffle Along launched her career.
Mm-hmm. Now, Florence Mill, very important personality that a lot of people don't talk about in terms of black theater history, but she was also became an international superstar, died at a very, very young age. And before we comment on her, I want to read this other person who I think very important also, Rose McClinton. She was born Rose Virginia Scott McClinton, born August 27, 1884. She died July 12, 1936. She was a leading African-American Broadway actress of the 20s. Rose McClinton, the Negro First Lady of the dramatic stage, was born in Greenville, South Carolina, under the name of Rosalie Virginia Scott. Rose was born in 1885 in South Carolina and as a child relocated to New York City. She started acting in church plays and as a child, but did not become a professional actress until she won a scholarship to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts when she was in her 30s. Her first claim to fame came in Deep River, a native opera with jazz in 1926. In addition to acting, she also directed several plays at the Harlem Experimental Theater. Rose appeared in the 1927 Pulitzer Prize-winning play In Ephraim's Blossom by Paul Green. In 1931, she was in another Paul Green play on Broadway, The House of Conley, which was the first production by the group theater directed by Lee Strasberg. She was a contemporary of Paul Robeson, Ethel Barrymore, Lynn Fontaine, and Langston Hughes. Hughes wrote a character for her in his 1935 play, Mulatto. Her talent extended to directing as well as acting. In 1935, she co-founded with Dick Campbell the Negro People's Theater in Harlem. A year later, McClinton died of pneumonia. Campbell and his wife, Muriel, founded the Rose McClinton Players. And this this Rose McClinton was very important in laying the foundation for some of your early theater personalities like Ruby Dee, Ozzie Davis, Sidney Poitier, et cetera, like them. Yeah. So let's comment. You want to comment on any of those pioneer African-American females?
What struck me first about Florence, you said she was the queen of happiness. I love that because happiness comes from within. It's not based on outer circumstances. And so that's something that comes from within you out. And you know how hard it was for black folks at those times, especially when these women were coming through. And so to maintain that joy is something that's quite inspirational. And then to build a business and have a career. I mean, both of these women building their own businesses is just extraordinary. That not only were they talented, but they were smart and capable and able to create a thriving business. Yvette, what do you think?
I was just thinking back because I haven't really thought about my theater history in a long time, but it's interesting that Florence Mills did shuffle along on Broadway, and I think that was a time when you had a lot of black shows or a lot of black takes of shows that were running on Broadway at that time, and that we were on Broadway, and then you had years and years when we weren't there at all. And as a playwright and as a producer, I never imagined that I would write a show that would be Broadway material in the sense of being a production that would be commercially accepted. But then in recent years, we've had Oprah Winfrey and Whoopi Goldberg and Jada Pinkett and Will Smith producing plays that we thought we would never see on Broadway, The Color Purple and Fela. Yes, Fela is a musical, but the fact that we now have more of a black presence in terms of the plays on Broadway, where we had such a huge absence, and so it was nice to be reminded of our early presence on Broadway when you brought up Florence Mills' name.
Okay, thank you. Now, Yvonne,
yes.
What's the reading? You're going to do a reading from the play of White House Wives. Can you do the setting and tell us about it?
Alma Powell is, of course, married to Colonel Colin Powell. And so in the play, she is the only African-American woman among these women. So she realizes how her husband has been treated because, you know, they come home and they tell their women, you know, they know. They know what's going on.
Okay.
And so she kind of lays it out. And I have to say, when we did the play in New York, the people would come up to me after the show and they would go, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that.
Okay.
So, ready to go?
Yes.
Okay. Well, in order to prevent the authorization for use of military force against Iraq resolution from being introduced, or worse, passing Congress next month, I'll do my part. Cole and I have a long-standing appointment for sex, and he wouldn't like me going AWOL. But Laura's right. Maybe a sex strike is a good idea. My colon has said from the very beginning that we should go after Osama where he lives, in Afghanistan, that we should go after Al-Qaeda, not Iraq. Your husbands have been looking for a reason, any reason, to bring Iraq into this. Colon told me he spent 2.5 hours trying to convince the president why we shouldn't invade Iraq, explaining to him the calamitous consequences of occupying an Arab country. Apparently, his efforts to persuade the president fell on deaf ears. It is clear that Dick and Donald want control over how and where the war on terrorism will be fought. Bunch of bloodthirsty, itchy finger trigger happy opportunists, a lot of them. My colon was to build an international coalition, unlike your husband's. My colon was opposed to a forcible overthrow of Hussein, preferring to continue on with a policy of containment. My colon wanted to bring the United Nations into this thing to keep some perspective, and yes, probably hoping that cooler heads would prevail if there were a UN war cabinet. Everybody knew that sanctions against Iraq had prevented the development of any weapons of mass destruction by Saddam Hussein. But what did Dick do? Dick went behind Colin's back and made a televised speech that sounded a lot like a declaration of war. Dick, who got 5 student deferments in order to avoid being sent to Vietnam because he had better things to do than to serve his country. Colin never in a million years thought that war with Iraq was in the minds of the war cabinet. But Dick and Donald have been relentless in pushing their agenda. What vice president do you know in the history of this country who has ever made repeated visits to the CIA asking analysts to look and look again and turn that rock over one more time? Vice president is supposed to preside over the Senate, attend ribbon-cutting ceremonies and funerals, and be on standby should the president be unable to carry out his duties of office. Now, if Condi had done her job and made sure that the president had been surrounded by many points of view on this thing, now maybe we wouldn't be in this mess. George Tenet should have stuck to his guns and told Dick to back off. At the very least, Condi should have told him to come back with a better case for war. I mean, what are we, a bunch of hoodlums? What? What was that? What did Colin say to the United Nations Security Council? Oh, you want to go there, huh? Okay, fine. Let's go there. He said, there can be no doubt that Saddam Hussein had biological weapons and the capability to rapidly produce more, many more, and that there was no doubt in his mind. That is what my colon said. It's true. But George Tenet told the president that the intelligence was a slam dunk. What he should have said was, Mr. President, you are about to make a big mistake. Dick sent my colon a pre-written speech, a speech he and Donald wanted him to give to the UN Security Council. Colon recognized that speech had more holes in it than a whore's panties and pitched it. Turning to your husband, Mrs. Tenet, for help. But what did he get? I'll tell you what he got. A bogus national intelligence estimate that was outdated and based on the testimony of an unreliable, alcoholic Iraqi exile. Did anyone tell Colin about this? About the Iraqi alcoholic? Did George Tenet or his staff? No. Instead, he sat right behind Colin on TV, knowing the whole time my Colin's testimony was based on the faulty intelligence his agency provided, for heaven's sake. If the Secretary of State can't believe the head of the CIA, who can he believe? George Tenet finds a way to support anything that Dick wants just to have access and a seat at the table. Old brown noser. Here's a hanky so you can wipe his nose off. Those men sent my colon out to slaughter, assuring him that the intelligence was ironclad. Before addressing the UN, colon told me that Dick joked with him, saying, you got high poll ratings. You can afford to lose a few points. What my colon has had to put up from all of your husbands is just the tip of the iceberg of what he would have to deal with if he had run for president. We've had phone calls, hate mail, people showing up on our doorstep, coming to our private residence, for heaven's sake. And he was only considering running for office at that point. A black man running for president is in a dangerous position in this country. No, I did not want him to run. My colon did not survive 2 tours in Vietnam and Desert Storm to be assassinated at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Okay. Thank you, Yvonne. We're winding down.
Thank you.
Thank you, Yvette, for calling in, for being a guest on the Qumran Report.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure. Okay. Such now, an honor.
I would like to extend a special thanks to our to my co-host, Earlene Anthony, my in-studio guest, Yvonne Farrell, on the line in New York, Yvette Heilager. So please come out and check out the play this coming Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Downtown L.A. Exchange. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and up on your family.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, great.
I want Americans and all the world to know American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
Every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.